Let's cultivate our motivation. And recall that we have a precious human life, which isn't just any human life, but it's one that has certain conditions that enable us to practice the Dharma. And so we have all those conditions now. It's a rare situation. And so it's something to be really valued and treasured. And so we want to make our life very meaningful. And the best way to do that is to develop our spiritual goals, to focus on creating the causes for enlightenment. Because as we create those causes, and later when we attain the result in enlightenment, we'll be more fit to be able to be of great benefit to other living beings, as well as to ourselves. Just generate that long-term motivation. So we always begin activities generating our motivation, because it's our motivation that determines really the value of whatever endeavor we do. It's not how we look and whether other people praise us or criticize us that makes what we're doing valuable or not. It's the attitude and our motivation that we're bringing to something. So that's why we really spend a lot of time working on this. Yeah, it's really important. And we always create a long-term motivation because that long-term motivation creates an incredible sense of space in our mind. You know, usually our minds are so limited and we're thinking, you know, how can I get my own pleasure ASAP? You know, and when the mind is in that state, there's a lot of difficulties. The mind's so narrow and just, you know, focused on me and what I want and my problems and what I like and I don't like and, you know, this kind of stuff. So the mind's not in a very happy state, and it's not in a state that's really of great benefit to anybody, so including ourselves. So that's why we create this long-term motivation, really remembering our long-term spiritual goal of full enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings. And even if that's going to take a few countless great eons, it's okay because it's something really valuable and wonderful to do. And it gives a whole different feeling to the actions we're doing now when we place what we're doing now within this bigger context. Okay, because if we place what we're doing now within the context of how can I feel good today, you know, it's like that's what makes us so stuck so often, you know. But when we place what we're doing now within this huge context of, you know, being of benefit to all the numberless, limitless, uncountable sentient beings, then, whoa, there's, you know, a sense of space in our mind for what we're doing. And that enables us to really continue doing something beneficial over a long period of time. That's why we always start with the motivation. Yeah, it's really, really important. So I thought today what I'd do is kind of tell you a little bit about the Abbey and how the Abbey is how what we're trying to do here is embodying different Dharma principles. Okay, so it's touching on some of the key Dharma values and principles and then how we're trying to live them here. And so including within that a little bit of the history of the development of the Abbey. Now, having graduated in history from UCLA, I learned two things, you know. Well, three things. One is that I forgot most of what I learned. Second thing I learned is that the past conditions the present. So it's helpful to learn history in not just in the sense of knowing what came before, because then we understand better what's happening now. And the third thing I learned about history is that whatever somebody tells you and whatever you read is not true. Okay, because, you know, history is just the telling of a story. So automatically it's told from a certain perspective. Okay, and so then you might think, well, the only way to know history is to live it. But even what you're living from a certain perspective. Okay, so even what we're living right now, we might think, oh, in years to come, people will ask us about the history that we're living now. But, you know, we're living our own experience. It's not the totality of what's going on in the universe right now. So, of course, when we later tell a history, you know, it's always through our experience and our version. Okay, so having qualified everything I'm saying in that way, I'm going to tell you a little of the history of the Abbey. I should also say another thing I learned from history is the way that it's usually told is it's from a male point of view and it's gossip. Okay? And it's just gossip that's written down, so people think that it's not gossip. They think it's true. And if it were told from a woman's point of view, totally different things, I think, would be discussed. Because the guys always like to talk about war and politics, and the women would be talking about, you know, how the families are brought up and different things like that. Although I think that's changing nowadays, but, you know. Okay, so the history of the Abbey. So that's why I started off with saying once upon a time. Okay, to indicate that you're not getting some kind of objective truth. Okay, so once upon a time, and it's hard to say when it all started, you know, because everything existed that had a cause, that had a cause, that had a cause. So I can't tell you what happened in previous lives. And I don't even know where to start in this life because there's so many causes. But I guess I could say, you know, I was among the first generation of Westerners to ordain in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And so the Tibetans are a refugee community. They're trying to sustain their own and rebuild their monasteries in India. And so they were happy to teach Westerners, but they couldn't really take responsibility for us. They would teach us, but they couldn't take responsibility in terms of providing for us and in terms of our sustenance. Because actually in Vinaya, when you ordain somebody, then, you know, the teacher is to, you know, help the disciple have their material wherewithal. So the Tibetans weren't really able to do that because they were a refugee community. And so us Western monastics were kind of left to roam around on our own. Lama Yeshe tried to form some communities. And so I had the opportunity to live in Dorje Poma Monastery in France in the early 80s. And I really loved living in community. I also lived in community in Copan in the 70s, late 70s. And I really loved living in the Sangha community because the Buddha, when he set up the Sangha, he did it as a community. It isn't that you take ordination and then you do your own trip. You take ordination and your ordination ceremony actually is admittance into a community. Yeah, and that's why you have to have a certain number of monastics to give the ceremony, because they're representing the whole community and they admit you into that community and give you the precepts that you hold in order to be a member of that community. And the focus of that community is enlightenment. you're all going in that direction. You're not going here, you're not going there, up or down, you're going towards enlightenment. Okay, so that's the purpose of the Sangha community. You know, it's a group of individuals who are all practicing, but they're practicing the same thing for the same purpose, and they're trying to support each other in their practice because they realize it's very difficult to practice on your own, as we know. Some of you were discussing that yesterday in the garden. You know, when you're practicing on your own, you get influenced by all sorts of other people and hard to, you know, stick to your spiritual aspirations. So I lived in community, both in India and Nepal, and then also in the West, and really liked it. But then I also had periods in my ordained life where I was really on my own, and, you know, it was challenging, and you have to be quite strong. And I really saw that the situation for Western Sangha was not getting better with the decades. It was still being kind of the same, you know, in the sense that people were ordained and then not having the opportunity to have proper training and not receiving the support that they needed to do that. So this idea came to start a monastic community. So it kind of came, I don't know, I guess it started way back in the 80s when I was living in France, and then, you know, a lot of other things happened. And I always wanted to start it in conjunction with somebody else because it's so hard to do things alone. So in the mid-60s, there was another nun, Venerable Tenzin Khatcha, and she and I started working together, developing the idea of Srivasti Abhi. And we... Thank you. I'm glad people... Somebody's listening and correcting me. The mid-90s. Thank you.
I was cooking it up before you went.
Yeah, I was doing other things in the Okay, the mid-90s. So she and I were working on this, and I was going to spring teachings one year in Dharamsala, and she was saying, oh, you know, ask His Holiness for a name, ask Him for a name for the monastery. And I'm going, well, you know, I'm not really so sure, because if I ask His Holiness for a name and He gives a name, then that means we really got to do it, you know. Because, yeah, you can't do that with His Holiness and then not carry through. And she said, ask Him for a name, ask Him for a name. So we wrote down some names, you know, different choices of names. And then we said, or whatever other name that, you know, you think would be good. And one of the names on the list was Srivasti Abhi. You know, Srivasti Abhi. The reason we chose Abhi was because an Abhi could be for both monks and nuns, and lay people could also stay there. So we didn't like the word nunnery. We didn't like the word monastery, you know. So we chose Abhi. And then Srivasti, we put on the list. I had been to Srivasti before, and I was really impressed at that place. It was where the Buddha spent 25 rainy seasons retreats, so a lot of the sutras were given there. And then also at the time of the Buddha, there was both a monk's community and a nun's community there. And I had this feeling, you know, because Western monastics are so few in number, it doesn't make sense to kind of duplicate everything. You know, it makes more sense to have one community live separately, but, you know, if you're having teachings or doing training, do it together, because, you know, then the teacher has to teach five people over here and then teach the same thing to five people over there, and it doesn't make much sense to me. Okay, so... anyway, that was one of the names on the list, and that happened to be the one that His Holiness chose. So then it was like, oh, okay, we got to do it now. And actually, I think we must have asked Him for the name. Maybe it was in 97 or even 98, not 96. Anyway, Venerable Tenzin got sick very soon afterwards. She had cancer and had to have surgery and so on and so forth. And so she kind of had to back out of the project at that point because of health reasons. So then I was kind of on my own with this name. what you're supposed to do. And I didn't really feel very confident about doing things, kind of starting it just being the only monastic doing it. Although I had been one time earlier on to see Rubu Rinpoche, who's a very, very nice older monk. He recently passed away. And I remember telling him, I want to do this, and, it's hard, I'm the only one, because all my other friends were busy with their own projects and studies and retreats and things. And Rinpoche just looked at me and he said, "You just make up your mind and do it." And I went, anyway, it stuck in my mind. Then in June of 2000, so it was like 5 years ago, I was at a Western Buddhist teachers conference in California, and I happened to meet a Theravada monk at that point, and he and I became friends. He had trained in Thailand for probably about 17 years at that point, and then he was in the process of coming back to America, and he wanted to set up a community. So we began discussing, and over a period of time we decided, well, why don't we just try making a community together? Go back to what it was like in ancient India, where you had people from different traditions living together. And we didn't have any money or anything. And there was a Chinese temple in Augusta, Missouri, outside of St. Louis. And they said, well, come here and, Well, you can kind of stay here and see what happens. And so we both went there. That was in the spring of 2002. And we had the idea maybe to try and do it with all three traditions, Chinese, Theravada, and Tibetan. Anyway, it was an ambitious project, but we really weren't sufficiently prepared to do it. And the place had already been established in Augusta, so they already had their rhythm and their way of doing things. So it was hard for he and I to both come in there having our own different ways of doing things to a community that already had their own way of doing things. So it didn't work out. And I got an email. I was in Madison, Wisconsin, receiving teachings from Geshe Zopa, one of my teachers. And I knew it wasn't working out in Missouri. I wasn't sure where I was going to go. And a friend of mine in Boise emailed and said, well, we want to have the monastery out here in Idaho. So come to Idaho and we'll help you. And I turned to my friend, who was another nun who I was staying at, I said, listen to this, Idaho, there's just a bunch of potatoes there. And she looked at me, she said, Idaho's beautiful, go. So I didn't really have a place to live, so I went. And so Dan and I, this was the Dan that many of you met over the weekend, we scoured Idaho, south and central Idaho, the whole region near Boise, looking for property. We found one place in Cascade that Nance saw, and we made an offer on that, but the owner was asking an outrageous price, and so they rejected our offer. We found another place outside of Cambridge, Idaho, and made an offer on that, and they also didn't accept it. And now I am so thankful for that neither of those offers got accepted, because looking at what we have now versus those two pieces of property, what we have now is far, far better as a site for an abbey than either of those were. So, you never know what's a setback and what's a hindrance and what's a blessing. Yeah? So, we were looking and we made these two offers. Nothing worked out. I went back to Wisconsin another summer to take more teachings from Geshe Zopa. And Dan continues the search, and he's writing me emails of, you know, I found a place that's 80 acres. It's 2 miles from the local county road, which is a gravel road. There's no electricity or telephone or water on it. The roads are plowed, you know, up to 2 miles near the place in the winter. It looks great. And he sent me pictures, and the property was beautiful. And I said, Dan, if I was 30, I would go for it, but I'm not 30. You know, so I really can't start with that right now. So then we had friends who lived in Cataldo, Idaho, which is east of Coeur d'Alene. And we asked them to because we weren't finding anything in southern central Idaho, to look in the north. So they had a realtor, and they began to get some places and go look. And, you know, they saw one place that was really beautiful until they walked a distance away, and then they saw that it kind of sagged in the middle because the beam in it was sagging. Yeah, they had a bunch of adventures looking for places. And I got the realtor's NSL listing and went online, back in Madison there, and looking at different properties, and took notes on all these properties that kind of were within our price range. And then I decided to look at the next price range up, you know, just for the heck of it. And I saw this house with a lot of windows. And I'm somebody who loves light and windows. And I was, you know, sitting there in my friend's house. I said, Java, come look at this one, you know. And she looked. I said, beautiful. You know, wow, it's gorgeous. And then we looked at the price and we said, wow. And I said, Java, you know, I can't do this. I can't do this. And this was the same nun who told me to go to Idaho. And she looked at me and she said, just go look at it. You know, just go look. Okay. So, August of 2003, another friend picks me up at the Spokane airport. We come up and we look here, and it looks really nice. You know, by this time I had seen a lot of properties. I wasn't jumping to any conclusions because I knew everything that you had to go through with planning and zoning and, you know, and all this stuff. And it was also way beyond what we could afford. But, you know, let's go look. So we were looking, and then we finished looking and came out here, and the realtor was going, and my friend said, well, let's just go to the walk up the meadow a little bit and look again. So we said goodbye to the realtor. Usually realtors don't like to leave prospective sellers on their own at a place prospective buyers, because the realtors don't want the buyers and sellers to talk to each other. You know, because they might come up with a better deal that doesn't include them. And so the realtor left, and my friend and I, we walked up to the upper meadow, and we're looking, and it's like so beautiful. And he says, let's go down and look at the barn again. Maybe we can remodel it and make it into a temple or something. So we walked down to the barn. So Harold, who was one of the previous owners, he and his wife Vicky, you know, owned the place. He was down in the barn. So my friend doesn't know that you're not supposed to tell the buyer all your financial information. And, you know, so we're talking to Harold, and my friend says, yeah, we really like the place, but we don't have enough money to buy it. We only, you know, we don't even have $300,000, and nobody's going to give a religious organization a loan. And, you know, what can we do? And Harold, he doesn't know that the seller is not supposed to tell the buyer, a prospective buyer, their financial stuff. So Harold says, oh, that's okay. We'll carry the mortgage for you. So, you know, it was really rather remarkable. And, you know, and we made an offer, and you know, they carried the mortgage. And so we were able to get the property. Now, I have to tell you a little bit of the background here. You know, there is no big Dharma organization behind the Abbey. When I started out, you know, with Venerable Tenzin in the 90s, we didn't have one penny, you know. There was no big already established Dharma Center organization that of whom we were a branch of. You know, we just started out completely fresh, without anything. And so the, you know, when we put down the down payment, the money that we had was money that was given to us by many, many different people. The Abbey isn't supported by one rich person who gives tons of money. And actually, I think it's better that way because sometimes, you know, if you get one person, they might try and control what's going on. But instead, it's like a lot of people just giving out of the goodness of their hearts. You know, people give $5, they give $500, they give $5,000. You know, so people give all different kinds of amounts. And that's how, you know, it happened. And that's how the Abbey is continuing to be run now. So we got the property in October of 03, and then in mid-October, Achala Manjushri and I moved in. Okay, so that's who was living here at the beginning. It was, you know, the two kitties and me. What is an interesting thing about in the history of the Abbey was if we back up a little bit, back into the 90s, in 98, I was in Dharamsala with one friend who was a Chinese nun, and I was telling her about, you know, my idea to start an abbey. And she said, well, I would like to offer the Buddha statue, if you do. And I said, wow, you know, we don't have a place yet, but sure, you know, get the statue and you know, and we'll keep it until we have a place. And so in Delhi, we ordered the statue. It's this statue, which was actually made in Nepal. And then, you know, it was shipped to Wisconsin because at some point I thought even of making the Abbey in Wisconsin, but then I realized that wasn't such a good idea either. So it got shipped to Wisconsin and it was stored in the basement of the Dharma Center there for many years until we finally got this place and then, you know, brought the Buddha here. So the Buddha, was the first one to come to the Abbey before we even had a home for him. Then, not too long after that, I was at Shasta Abbey because we have these monastic conferences of mostly Western and some Asian monastics every year where we get together and talk and get to know each other and about our traditions. So one year it was held at Shasta Abbey, which is a Zen monastery in Northern California. And the abbot said, you know, some people gave us some Tibetan tankas and we would like to give them to you because we feel like it's, you know, it would just be more suitable for you to have them. You know, because they knew I wanted to start a place. And I said, well, I don't have a place, but sure. So they donated these two tankas of Maitreya and Manjushri. Okay. Now, when you visualize the Tree of Assembled Gurus, there, yeah, or you visualize the refuge visualization for our tradition, the center figure is the Buddha, okay? Here the center figure is Lama Tsongkhapa, but in his heart is the Buddha, you know? So the central figure is the Buddha. On the Buddha's right, or on the left as we look at the Tanka, is Maitreya Buddha, and he is said to be the one who carried down the stream of teachings on what's called the vast or extensive teachings. And so those are the teachings on the method side of the path. So they include how to develop the determination to be free, how to develop bodhicitta. Okay, so Maitreya is kind of the head of that lineage. on the Buddha's left or on the right as we look at it, the central figure, I can show you later, you know, when we're closer there, is Manjushri, who is the head of the wisdom lineage. So we always talk about, you know, method and wisdom going together, and those two lineages of teachings. And so what are the two tankas that come to us right after the Buddha are Maitreya and Manjushri. Okay? So they came to Srivasti Abbey before we had a home. Then we have to even back up. Actually, the first to come to the Abbey was back in, this must have been, when was it? This was probably in maybe 95 or 96, somewhere around that, 95, 96. I got a phone call from, because I was living in Seattle at the time with Dharma Friendship Foundation. I was the resident teacher there for 10 years. And I got a phone call from some other Buddhist friends who were part of the center, but we were, you know, very good friends. And they called me and they said, you know, we were in Asia and we wanted to get some Buddhist books. So we ordered the Kangyur and the Tengyur. The Kangyur is the Buddha's words and the Tengyur are the major Indian commentaries. And we thought that it was like the Bible, you know, just one book. You know, just a few books here, a few books there. And we just got this thing from the shipping agency that the Kangyur and Tengyur arrived in Seattle, and it's $300 and it's, no, 300 volumes, and it's over $2,000, it's over $3,000, and we don't have the money, and we don't know what to do, and do you want them? And I'm going, and, you know, the royalties for my books, you know, we have this thing in the Tibetan tradition that we don't use the royalties from, not the royalties, but we don't use any money that is made from selling Dharma items to eat or, you know, for your own personal needs. That's considered very negative karma to, you know, for my teachers taught to use that for, you know, just for our own sustenance or whatever. So the royalties from my books I had always kept in a special account that I used for Dharma items or to make donations or, you know, for some special kind of need. So as it happened, there was that money sitting in that special account and it couldn't be used for just any old thing, you know. So getting the Kangyur and Tengyur was like the perfect way to use that money. So we got the Kangyur and Tengyur. You know, so actually the Dharma was the first to arrive at the Abbey, you know, and that was in the mid-90s. Then, you know, 98, we got the Buddha and thereafter the Maitreya and Manjushri. And then it wasn't until the autumn of 03 that we actually moved in here. I think it's kind of interesting that whole development. Yeah. Anyway, that's a little bit about the history. You know, we moved in and then, you know, things have been progressing since then. You know, when we first came, there was just that, you know, the only living space was the upper floor of the house. So we had to remodel downstairs. And then this was a garage. We can show you some pictures of what it looked like before. Ulrich knows. So we remodeled this into a meditation hall. So those two things were done in the first year. And then the second year, we built the writing studio, which is where I'm staying. I'm sure some of you want to come out and see the inside of it. And then we also remodeled that Bay of the Barn where some of you are staying, you know, into the community room. And we winterized the cabin so that people can stay there. So that was last year's projects. Okay. Anyway, what I wanted to get into a little bit more, I didn't intend to tell the history for so long, but anyway, it happened. Maybe I'll pause now. Do you have any questions about what I said so far? Yeah.
Was it Venerable
Jindy
coming into the statue?
No, it wasn't Venerable Jindy. It was another nun from Jade Buddha Temple in Texas.
How's
Venerable Kendon? She healed very well, and she was teaching in Colorado, and now she's down in L.A. organizing His Holiness's visit. She hasn't been here. Yeah, really like for her to come. Miles, you remember what it looked like too at the beginning. Miles slept on the concrete floor. The room that you're staying in, Elspeth, you know, was originally, it actually wasn't even a room. It was just, you walked in from what's now the office, and it was just one big thing. And so Miles slept there, I remember. On the concrete with a mat. But yeah, the things were quite different then.
And just to emphasize that everything was done by volunteers.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything was donated.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the beds you're sleeping on, you know, we didn't get, people donated them, and people donated supplies. The whole downstairs was remodeled by people who came and volunteered and did that. This was transformed. We had to get a contractor because we had to take off the roof and build that part. So the contractor did the outside, but the whole inside was done by volunteers. Okay. Most of the writing studio and the barn bay was done by volunteers. The writing cabin was, you know, remodeled by, the retreat cabin was remodeled by volunteers. And all the funds were given. You know, we don't have any business at all.